Okay, so we're recording. So this is the afternoon lab, Monday afternoon, April 20th. And just a couple of notes on where we stand in the lab and what my expectations have been to date. And then we've got a great lab today that we're going to talk about, which was the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid. So this is one of my favorite labs to introduce besides doing the TLC lab. TLC lab, I think, is my absolute favorite, but this one is a really killer one too. So this is a good lab lecture. But let's talk about lab expectations. So we completed experiments 1 through 4. So that was solubility. Extraction was the last one. So experiment 4 was extraction. 5 was chromatography, but we didn't complete it. 3 was, go back and look at where we were. 3 was crystallization. 2 was the solubility. So what was due for these in the extraction lab was the lab notes, the question section, and the report section. These are just questions. The report section is just a separate set of questions, but it's not like a report. It's just different questions within Pavia. Report section as well. And those were all due with the lab notes. The crystallization similarly was the lecture notes, the report section, and the question section. So this was similarly the lab notes, questions, and the report section. And solubility was the same thing. So I'm just gonna write same here. Those were all due in. And so if you didn't get them turned in and you want to complete those report sections and those question sections and turn those in, that would be great. And you can still turn those in and get credit for doing all of those. Then we did part of the chromatography. So when we got down to 5, we only did part of chromatography. And the rest of it was done digitally, was done online. Distillation was 6. 7 was the boiling point. And FTIR unknowns. So for these here, nothing due. I'm not going to have you complete any work for those or go in and try and reproduce work for that. It just, those experiments were too specific to actually getting the data and working with the data that was in there. So I'm not going to have you turn anything in for the chromatography, the distillation, or the boiling point unknowns. What we're doing today, experiment 8, is the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid. And for this one, it's going to take, I think, 3 days. First day will be the actual synthesis, where we'll talk about it. The second day is expectations on the product and the product workup, characterization, we'll say. And the last one, on the last day, we're going to do formal reports. And it's here that when we start talking about formal reports and putting formal reports together, that I think that I'm going to have you guys do some writing exercises. And you'll be dealing with some of the questions and things in those, in that formal report writing. I won't actually have you write a whole formal report, because that doesn't make sense in the context of what we're actually going to do. But what I think that we will do is talk about writing and have you guys write various sections, like practice writing an abstract, practice writing a discussion section, practice writing an introduction section, those types of things. And we'll build it in and give you guys some writing exercises to do. So for the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid, I think we will have some things that are due that I will, that I can assign logically and have you guys work on, but nothing for 5, 6, or 7. So if you were feeling lost in lab and wondering, hey, I'm really not getting things done, or I'm worried about missing content and not getting things turned in, then I want to sort of, allay those fears and say, yeah, we didn't do anything for those and I didn't have you turn anything in. So, Finn, I don't remember which labs I've turned in already, so I don't know if I'm up to date. Finn, I can help you with that and I can look them up for you. I also went through yesterday, it took me a long time. I didn't realize how much chaos I was going to create by having you guys turn in everything with just photographs. And the photographs coming into my email and interspersed all throughout my email, and then trying to find everybody. So I had to do a search on each person's name, find everything that they turned in, put it all into a file, and then rename them so that I could tell what exercises they actually were. Because a lot of you just turned in pictures with the name of the picture, which was 5679234.jpg, whatever, which was really fun trying to figure out what the heck that was. So, and a lot of the pictures were sideways, which also makes it really hard to deal with. So I straightened everybody's pictures out. I turned them all into PDFs. Ones that were very hard to read, I lightened up so that I could actually read them. I retitled them so I know what they are, and I have them in your folder so I know exactly what you've turned in. So so I can go through and I can tell you if you're missing things, if you want to message me individually or hit me during office hours, I'll walk through what I've got for you and make sure that you see everything that I've got. And I'll get those graded now that I've got them all sort of like sorted out. Now I can go through and actually get them graded and stop freaking out and panicking myself at not knowing it, where everything is or what's come in. And so that's where we stand. Okay. Hopefully that takes some of your anxiety away in knowing what's come in or what needs to be turned in or where we're at. How does that sound so far? I'm kind of looking, I've got things over at the screen over here as opposed to over here right now, because I'm going to use notes on this screen so I can look and talk to you more directly. But I'm going to look over here for head nodding every once in a while and point over at this screen, and I'm seeing some thumbs up, so that's good. Okay, sounds like a plan. Finn's on board. Everybody's on board. I'm liking it. Okay, then let's talk about today's lab, which is the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid. And this is one of my favorites because it's the first time that we get to do synthesis. This is the first lab where we're taking everything that we've learned through the first 7 labs and putting it into practice all into one lab and doing a synthesis from start to finish. It's the first time you've actually done an organic transformation, taking one material and turning it into something new and then proving that you actually turned it into that new thing. So that's what's really exciting about this lab. The other thing is that's cool about it is that it's making aspirin. It's making something that is so utilitarian, that is so such a basic medication that we just oftentimes take it for granted how important aspirin really is. Aspirin is a multi-billion dollar industry just in selling aspirin itself, and it treats so many different things. It treats inflammation. It treats pain. It treats fever. It treats heart disease. There's just so many different things that aspirin actually does. And it is one of the first pharmaceuticals that we ever had. It was first synthesized in 1853. So all the way back, and it wasn't until like the beginning of 1900 that it was actually synthesized commercially and turned into a consumer product. And it has some side effects for children, not always great for children, that some children can have an allergic reaction to aspirin. Taken in too great a quantity, it can cause ulcers, it can cause bleeding, it can cause all kinds of things, internal bleeding and hemorrhaging. And so the side effects are great enough that if aspirin were to come onto the market today, it would probably be a prescription drug, not an over-the-counter drug, which is interesting to think about. But anyway, so there's many things that are cool about aspirin. And not only has it been a consumer drug for a very long time, but it is one of the first analgesics, one of the first drugs that in the history of humans that we knew about. And so going all the way back to antiquity, acetyl salicylic acid, or salicylic acid really, has been known not as a molecule itself, but as an extract from plants, that certain plants we knew had medicinal properties. And that when those plants were either consumed, eaten, or when a tea was brewed from those plants, that tea could cause fever reduction, or that tea could cause reduction in pain or swelling, and all of those properties. And so that's been known since, I don't know, 2000 BC or earlier. The first time, let's talk about salicylic acids. So what we're doing is the synthesis of acetyl salicylic acid. And it's derived from salicylic acid. Salicylic acid is the natural product. It is a beta hydroxy acid. This is salicylic acid. And its name comes from salix. Salix is Latin for willow tree. And this is the natural product. It is produced in plants that are in the family that is the salicylate family. And all of the salicylate plants produce salicylic acid, and salicylic acid is basically a plant hormone. I don't know what job it does in the plants, but it's a plant hormone that helps the plant to do something, signaling of some type within the plant. And it was known as early as 4500 BC to 1900 BC in ancient Sumer. The ancient Sumerians used willow bark to reduce fevers and to reduce pain. And we have evidence of that on clay tablets, where from ancient Sumer, those clay tablets actually talk about the use of willow bark in teas to reduce fever and things. It was also known from ancient Egypt in 1550 BC on a papyrus scroll. We have the description of how salicylate-rich plants such as willow bark were used to treat inflammation and treat pain. So all the way back from very ancient times, it was known that certain plants had medicinal properties, and they didn't know what it was that was in the plant that was doing it. But they knew that when they made a tea from these plants, that they could reduce pain and reduce inflammation. And so it wasn't until the mid-1800s, so in 1853, the first time that there was a synthesis done, was done by Charles Friedrich Gerhardt. And what the interest was that when salicylic acid was isolated on its own, it was found to be too acidic to be used as a medication on its own. So extracts from willow bark were too acidic. They could be taken in tea, but not in concentrate. And that tea was very bitter, but couldn't be taken in concentrate. it formed ulcers, and it was too acidic and too damaging to the mucous membranes and the linings of the stomach. So there was interest in trying to make a compound that had the same properties as salicylic acid, but could be distributed in a solid form that could be taken like a pill to treat all of these different different health effects. And so what Charles Frederick Gerhardt did, and I get mixed up, I need to look back in my history and understand which person did which, but one of the main things was, and I think it was Gerhardt, his father had rheumatoid arthritis. And in trying to give him salicylic acid, it was causing the stomach upset and it couldn't be tolerated. And so Gerhardt had a personal interest in trying to produce a medication that could treat his father's rheumatoid arthritis without causing the ulcers and the stomach upset and things. And so he had a personal investment in trying to find a compound that would do this. And he took sodium salicylate, the sodium salt of the salicylic acid, and reacted it with acetic chloride, an acid chloride, and formed the acetylsalicylic acid. And I don't know much about the reaction itself here because I don't know the rest of the conditions. So I don't know the entire mechanism by which this worked, because I don't know if he did it with an amine base or what base he used or how he worked it up. But this was the first recognized synthesis of acetylsalicylic acid. Then in 1897, the Bayer Company got involved. And scientists at the Bayer Company devised another synthesis. And what they did is they started off with salicylic acid and reacted not the sodium salt, but the salicylic acid itself with acetic anhydride. And they did the first large-scale synthesis of this with an acid catalyst. And it produced acetylsalicylic acid and a byproduct of acetic acid. Acetic acid being the same acid that we ingest as vinegar and is generally non-toxic and easy to eliminate out of this. And so this actually is what made the Bayer Company really one of the leading pharmaceutical companies in the world, was that they were the first ones to produce a natural product, convert it into an actual medication, acetylsalicylic acid, and placing this acete group onto the molecule causes the molecule to be much less acidic in the stomach. It basically buffers it and has the same activity, biological activity, as the original salicylic acid. It reduces fever, reduces inflammation, treats heart disease, and reduces pain, all of those things, and is still active. So that's the synthesis that we plan to do today. And the question is, how does this actually work? So I like, since we're in sort of a digital format here anyway, and we can't really go through and do the experiment, talking about the mode of action and how it works is a little bit more something that we can do and is interesting. So how does this actually work? Mode of action. So the mode of action is that when your body is damaged, your body synthesizes what are called prostaglandins. The prostaglandins are a set of hormone-like molecules made from fatty acids. And these molecules are made on demand when the body senses damage, and they stimulate not exactly the immune response, but the inflammation response, the response that triggers your body to start healing itself. So inflammation is an outpouring of molecules that go to the damaged area to start carrying away the damaged area and start repairing the damage. And sometimes that gets out of control and out of whack, such as in certain types of arthritis that are autoimmune arthritis diseases, where the body's inflammation cycle has gotten out of whack and is starting to tear down normal tissue and cause more damage. That's the prostaglandins sort of getting a little bit out of control. But prostaglandins are made from fatty acids, the same fatty acids that make up your triglycerides are used to make these prostaglandins, and they're hormone-like materials. So this one is prostaglandin E2. And let's copy that. We'll paste it over here and we'll give you another example of another prostaglandin. So we'll clean it up a little bit, put in another hydroxy group up on top, and I think everything else the same. And this is prostaglandin this is F2 alpha. So these are just different examples of prostaglandins, and these molecules are responsible for the inflammation signaling within your body. These prostaglandins, like I said, are made on demand, and they are made from fatty acids. And one of those fatty acids that they are made from is arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is a 20-carbon carboxylic acid, a fatty acid. And I'm drawing it in an artificially sort of skewed way, sort of like a clothespin, or a bobby pin, in order to represent it like a prostaglandin. Because what happens here, this is the arachidonic acid. What arachidonic acid does is react with oxygen through an enzyme called cyclooxygenase. That is the first step in synthesizing the prostaglandin. So I want to put two oxygens there, and then the rest of this molecule has very much the same structure as the starting material. Except for on the bottom side down here, we get the trans double bond, hydroxyl group going back, and then the rest of the carbon chain. Yeah, I think that's the whole thing. So hopefully I've done everything right. I just want to move it over a little bit. Okay. And if you think about that cyclooxygenase as an enzyme, the cyclooxygenase binds to arachidonic acid. And if we think about sort of the prostaglandin synthesis, it's not exactly what I wanted to do. Let's leave it open like that. And we think about this as the enzyme. And this is the cyclooxygenase. And this is the binding pocket for the arachidonic acid. Then what happens is the arachidonic acid fits in there and gets converted in this first step into a prostaglandin. oh, this would have gone through many more steps in order to actually make the prostaglandin. This was just the first step. But what acetylsalicylic acid does is it adds in an acete group into the binding site, and that acete group gets transferred in here and basically blocks access to the binding site, deactivating the enzyme. And so what happens is that molecule, arachidonic acid, can no longer fit in the binding pipe, in the binding site, and therefore it can't be synthesized into a prostaglandin. And without the prostaglandins, then you don't have the inflammation cycle. So it decreases the inflammation, it decreases the pain, it decreases fevers, all of those things that prostaglandins would have done that that we think of as your body fighting an infection or fighting damage. The body can still heal itself. It just attenuates how much prostaglandins are being synthesized and attenuates the pain and attenuates the inflammation and all those things that come with it. So that's how acetylsalicylic and salicylic acid actually work, is by regulating the synthesis of the prostaglandins, the hormone type molecules, which is just kind of a cool aside. I like to know how that kind of works and where that's coming from. Okay. So, hey, and by the way, I'm looking at notes that are on my screen in a different location than what I normally do with paper and things. And so I may not see questions. If you guys have questions or want me to stop, by all means, feel free to unmute your microphone for a second, jump in and let me know that you've got a question and let me deal with it, because I might miss it and I don't want to miss it. I don't want to just keep rambling if you guys really want to ask something. Okay. All right. Let's deal with looking at this reaction in a little bit more detail, because we've got to do a couple of things mechanistic-wise to understand the reaction, but I also want to understand all of the reagents that are going into this reaction. And we've got a new reagent that we haven't seen before, and that's the acetic anhydride. And then we use phosphoric acid, H3PO4, as a catalyst here to make the acetylsalicylic acid. Okay, so first off, a couple of things. Let's talk about this salicylic acid for a second. We said salicylic acid was a beta hydroxy compound. And so the beta position, that's alpha, beta position is here. But it's not really just a beta hydroxy compound, it's really a phenol. So when I take a look at that whole thing, that part of the functional group there is a phenol. And phenols are a little bit different than alcohols. So we should understand the difference between a phenol and an alcohol. When we look at an alcohol, something like ethanol, the pKa on that proton is about 15.7, almost 16 for the acidity of that proton. In a phenol, the pKa of the proton is much closer to 9. And when we look at a carboxylic acid, the pKa of the proton is down at 4.5. And so phenols are much more acidic than alcohols are by orders of magnitude because of their pKa. And that has to do with the electron withdrawing nature, both resonance and induction of the aromatic ring system. So we have the sp2 hybridized carbon that's in there that is electron withdrawing. We have resonance where the negative charge can delocalize into the ring. All of those things help to stabilize the conjugate, making the proton that much more acidic. And so phenols are more acidic than alcohols are, but not as acidic as carboxylic acids. So we have an acidity difference there within the salicylic acid. And the name phenol, which is also important to note, because sometimes in my pronunciation, I want to hit phenol, which is the aromatic alcohol, and a phenyl, P-H-E-N-Y-L, which is a substituent, an aromatic ring system as a substituent is a phenyl group. So we have a phenol ending in O-L, which I try to exaggerate sometimes, and a phenyl, which is an aromatic ring as a substituent, both names sounding very similar, but wanting to make sure that we hit those differences. Okay, let's take that and let's talk about that acetic anhydride. Anhydrides are a class of compounds that are fairly reactive, made from condensing carboxylic acids. Anhydrides can be symmetric or asymmetric. So we can think about R binding to a carbonyl, an oxygen, a carbonyl, and then an R prime, where R and R prime can be equal or they cannot be equal. Just depends on the anhydride itself. Acetic anhydride is made by condensing acetic acid. So you take two acetic acids and you heat the snot out of it. We drive off water and we create the acetic acid or the acetic anhydride. So an anhydride means a product by which water has been eliminated. Anhydrous means absence of water. Anhydride means to eliminate water. So we have driven water off of this in this way, not very efficiently, but driving it off as a gas through the heat and leaving behind the acetic anhydride, which I believe has a higher boiling point than the water does. I need to check that. But so anhydrides generally are made through an endothermic process of condensing two carboxylic acids. And there are more efficient ways to be able to make an anhydride than this, but they have a fairly high activation energy and the products are much higher in energy than were the reactants, which means that this is now very reactive. It's a very reactive molecule. And it's very reactive in that it is a strong electrophile. The carbonyls each bear a large partial positive, and the molecule is looking for electron density. And such that if I take it and react it with water, the process in reacting it with water liberates two of the acetic acids, plus I get a lot of heat. That this is an exothermic reaction. So acetic anhydride breaks down in the presence of water and the reaction goes in reverse. And the heat that we are getting out is equal to the amount of energy that we put into it essentially in order to make the acetic anhydride. So that's a little bit about acetic anhydride. One thing to think about is that your skin has hydroxyl groups on it. So in working with this reagent, should you happen to spill this reagent onto your skin, it reacts in the same way that it reacts with most other hydroxyl groups. It reacts to form a chemical bond with the hydroxyl, putting an acete group onto your skin. So this group here is called the acete group. And it's a two carbon group. So that's carbon number one and carbon number two with the carbonyl on it. That's an acetyl group or acete group. The other thing that happens is it liberates an equivalent of acetic acid, plus it liberates heat. So when it hits your skin, it does three different types of things. It gives you a chemical burn. It gives you a mineral acid burn. And it gives you a heat burn. Not one of the things you really want to get on your skin. So it deserves a certain amount of respect when working with it. It is one of the more dangerous compounds that you have worked with to date, because most of the compounds that you've worked with to date are neutral, generally, and not very reactive. So you've worked with a lot of alcohols. You've worked with a lot of solid carboxylic acids. You've worked with a number of just hydrocarbons. You've worked with some things that are carcinogenic, like methylene chloride. But in terms of reactivity, in terms of hurting you, damaging you in an accident, this is one of the more serious chemicals that you've worked with. The other one that I would say is you've used concentrated HCl. You've used concentrated H2SO4, concentrated sulfuric acid. Those two I would put more dangerous than I would put the acetic anhydride, because those concentrated acids char your skin immediately. But the acetic anhydride is a close second in being careful. And should you spill it, we treat it much the same way as spilling a strong acid. We treat it with sodium bicarbonate to neutralize it. We neutralize it till the bubbling stops, and then we can clean it up. If you happen to get it on your skin, you immediately treat your skin with water at the sink, with flushing it with plenty of water. We sometimes will make a sodium bicarbonate paste and apply it to the skin, and then back in the water again. When they say 15 minutes in the water, for most chemicals, I would say wash your hands with soap and water for the things that we have been dealing with. With this one, this is one where I would keep you in the water for an extended period of time, more like 15 minutes, in order to try to use the Chatelier's principle to make sure that we remove all of that acetic anhydride. So sodium bicarbonate is your friend. Water is your friend in case of spilling it. Okay, I'm going to move down to a full new page down here, because we're going to start the mechanism of how the reaction works. So reaction mechanism. This is usually an important part of not only the talk, so that we understand how, what is its pKa? It doesn't have, Elian, that's a good question. It doesn't have an inherent pKa. It does, but not in the way that we think of as an acid. It's a different type of acid. If we were to think about its pKa, you're asking, what is the pKa of a proton out here? And that proton is not acidic in the same way that other acids are acidic. So if I had to guess at the pKa of that proton, I would put that somewhere probably in the 26 range, which is not acidic in the way that when we were looking at alcohols, it's not even as acidic as an alcohol. It's much less acidic than an alcohol, but its acidity lies in the way that it reacts as a Lewis acid with other nucleophiles. So it's a different type of acid in that way. It's more of a Lewis acid than it is of a Bronsted-Lowry acid. So the pKa is not as relevant as it is, because we don't measure the pKa of Lewis acids in the same way that we measure pKa's. pKa means pK acid, which means proton. So Lewis acids have an equilibrium constant that we could talk about, but is not relevant or comparable to a pKa in that way. Okay, good question. Thank you. The reaction mechanism is important to understanding how the acetylsalicylic acid is formed and how the reaction progresses. It's also important in terms of, this is our first chemical reaction, and learning the language of how we talk about reaction mechanisms. Because when we start to write reports, what you're going to be asked to do is, in Chem 1B, your main focus was on your, not your percent yield, but your percent correctness. I can't remember what the actual term is, but for most of the things that you did in Chem 1B, you were more concerned with how close were you to the real answer. And so what you did was you calculated a percent difference. That's what you actually did. And you talked about that percent difference with the actual answer. Here we talk about percent yields, but your percent yield may be really good or may not be as good. And it's not only the percent yield, but the characterization. Did we make what we say we made? And also being able to talk about the reaction mechanism, break it down and use the appropriate language to be able to discuss each step. And that's an important aspect of being able to understand the mechanism. So we're going to go in through the mechanism in fairly deep detail because our focus within an organic paper is in the mechanism itself. We spend a lot of time in the discussion section focused on the mechanism and being able to break it down and use that vocabulary so that we can both understand it, but also use that vocabulary more in the lecture area as well. So it enhances our understanding of being able to talk about lecture reaction mechanisms. And that's an important part of the course. So let's take and write down this reaction one more time. And then note that this reaction is acid catalyzed. And like most organic reactions, we write the reagent up here, which is the main transformative reagent. So we'll call this the substrate. This we'll call the reagent, even though they're both reactants. And then this has an H3PO4 phosphoric acid catalyst. And we are making the product, which is the acetyl salicylic acid. And this reaction being acid catalyzed, when your first step, when your reaction is acid catalyzed, your first step is going to be a protonation. When a reaction is base catalyzed, your first step is a deprotonation. Just as a general rule. So if you're trying to figure out where to start in a reaction mechanism, asking yourself, am I under basic conditions or am I under acidic conditions, can generally help you to figure out what your first step is. Once you figure out the first step, then everything sort of like flows into place and gets a little bit easier. Okay, so we are acid catalyzed and we're going to start off with a protonation. And we're going to use a couple of different colors on things. So I think I'm going to, let's keep the acetic anhydride purple. And in starting off, we've got three different oxygens that we can protonate, but we've done this before. So we could ask the question, which of these oxygens is the most basic? And if we protonated, this is really cool. I think I might've shown you this in lecture already, but they added a laser pointer into my application just over the weekend, which made me very, very happy that I've got a laser pointer now. So the oxygen here that's in the center, if I protonate that, there's no resonance. If I protonate the outside oxygen, a carbonyl, then I can lift the oxygen electrons up onto the oxygen. I get a carbocation. I can push the electrons into here. And I got three different resonance contributors. And so the most basic site, the site that is most likely to be protonated, is the carbonyl. And again, I should probably show the lone pairs. I tend not to because we kind of know that they're there. And so I tend not to draw the lone pairs most of the time, but it's important to realize and remember that the lone pairs are there. So once we protonate this, oh, there's something else I'm using here. This guy, B. I tend to use B as a general base. It means that it could be anything. And I tend to use HB as sort of my general acid. And that these two are conjugates. And they're not. It could be that this could have an anion on it, or it might be neutral. It just depends on what it is that is my basic species. But I tend to use B as my general base, and that B just comes from the idea of base, because there are many different things in solution that can act as a base. And we'll see that as we go through the reaction mechanism, anything that receives a proton is acting as a base in solution. And so we could say that in solution, you have any number of bases. And to say that one base in particular is making a reaction mechanism move forward is probably not entirely true, that it is probably true that within solution, there are many different molecules that can act as a base and do act as a base to promote the reaction mechanism to going forward. So I tend not to get stuck or hung up on any one particular base. I tend to like to use the general base, and we'll do that a lot within lecture as well. You guys will get used to sort of seeing me do that. And anytime you need an acid, you can always pull out HB. And anytime you need a base, you can always pull out B or B minus and use them as a base. Okay, so we go through the protonation and we protonate the acetic anhydride. And once protonated, the acetic anhydride is said to be activated. This sort of activated idea what it means is that this is a stronger nucleophile, electrophile, stronger electrophile. So whereas we had a small partial positive at the base of the carbonyl carbon before, once I protonate it, this partial positive charge is dramatically increased. We can see the increased nature of that if we go through and draw the resonance contributors, such that I can lift the electrons up and I can demonstrate a full positive charge on the carbon. And I can move the electrons over and shift that positive charge onto the center oxygen. So there are three resonance contributors that happen with this molecule, and they enhance the positive charge at the carbonyl carbon, making it a stronger electrophile. So what I'm going to do is, because I've drawn all of that resonance there, I'm going to take the molecule. This is not the way I like to do a reaction mechanism. I usually like to do my reaction mechanisms all sort of linearly and following through. But let's just say that what I've got here is represented in this protonated species. And this is all I would have drawn rather than drawing out all the resonance. And underneath it, I will draw my salicylic acid, which then starts my reaction. And I'm drawing my salicylic acid upside down from what I have drawn it, because I want to not turn anything around once I start the reaction mechanism. So when I start a reaction mechanism, everything that I draw, I want to keep in as much the same orientation as possible so as not to confuse students and not to confuse myself. It is one of the best practices to learn, besides numbering, that when you're trying to not turn things around, that keeping everything oriented in the same orientation and keeping everything numbered in the same direction, clockwise or counterclockwise, is two of the most important skills you can get when drawing reaction mechanisms. So I'll draw it upside down because this is the oxygen using its lone pairs that does the nucleophilic attack into the carbonyl carbon, breaking the carbonyl bond and shifting the electrons up onto the carbonyl oxygen. And so we'll draw just that much and take that forward. And remember, if you have questions at any point, feel free to interrupt me and ask those questions.
I have a little question.
Go for it.
That's the salicylic acid substrate, right?
That is the salicylic acid, which is now coming in and doing a nucleophilic attack. So the salicylic acid is attacking the acetic anhydride.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah. And now the positive charge is now formally on the salicylic acid phenol oxygen. And it is the phenol oxygen which does the attacking. The phenol oxygen is much more nucleophilic than either of the carboxylic acid oxygens.
I have a quick question.
Go for it.
What solvent would we use for this? That, because I'm thinking that there might be an issue where the solvent would attack the reagent.
Absolutely. Eric, that's a great question. And in reality, that question comes up a little bit later, but there is no solvent. The solvent is the acetic anhydride itself. So acetic anhydride is being used as the solvent in the chemical reaction.
That's handy.
So, yeah, there's no competing component there. So yeah, you're absolutely right. If we wanted to do this in a solvent, the appropriate solvent to try to do this in would be sort of an ether solvent, which could not be nucleophilic, but still would be, what do I want to say? Not electronegativity, but polarity would still be polar enough to be able to support the reagents. Hydrocarbons would not be ideal because of the charged intermediates that we're going to create, and the charged intermediates would not be solubilized within a hydrocarbon solvent. So you need a solvent which is aprotic and also non-nucleophilic, and something like THF would be a good choice. Diethyl ether might be another good choice. There's a number of different solvents that we could choose that would do the job. But because of the nature of acetic anhydride, it's a great solvent all in itself, and you can just do it in the solvent. Okay, that's a great question. All right, once we form this adduct, an adduct is a joining together of two molecules. What we do then is that general base comes back into play and takes the proton. Oh, let's keep doing arrows in red just so that makes it a little bit easier to see. Take the proton and the bond breaks and the electrons go back to the oxygen, thereby getting rid of the positive charge. And we go to a neutral intermediate. The neutral intermediate we can call the adduct, or oftentimes like to call it the adduct. An adduct is just the combination of two molecules that have been brought together in a chemical reaction forming a single molecule. So we could say that this molecule now is the neutral adduct. The reaction mechanism continues through another protonation. So that acid catalyst is really important in that BH comes back in and we protonate another oxygen. The oxygen that gets protonated this time is the other carbonyl on the acetic anhydride. And one of the questions that we can ask, which is a great question, is why this oxygen? Why not this oxygen, or this one, or this one, or that one, or that one? I mean, there's so many oxygens to choose from. Why this left-hand oxygen? It's a carbonyl. And so, yeah, there's some resonance, but there's other carbonyls and other places where I can get resonance. There's lots of other places where I could protonate. And the answer is that all five of these oxygens can be protonated and do get protonated. But let's look at this one, for instance. If this oxygen here were to get protonated, then what would happen is I would step back to the charged intermediate and it would be a reversible step. That does happen, but it's a reversible step and it doesn't take the reaction mechanism forward. Each one of these oxygens, when protonated, takes you forward to another step, but every one of those is reversible and doesn't go anywhere or lead to anything. And so what winds up happening is there's only one oxygen that, when protonated, the reaction mechanism steps forward, rather than just going into these reversible steps. And that's the oxygen that we're showing in the upper left-hand corner there. So let's get rid of all of these guys. And then we'll move this forward. And we're going to move it onto a new page here. So I'm going to shrink this down so you can kind of see where we came from. We'll step it down. So we protonate the carbonyl that was the only remaining carbonyl of the acetic anhydride. We have the new bond that was made to our salicylic acid. Probably drew that larger than I needed to, but it was zoomed out a little far. Okay. And the reason that it binds here and does this is it forms what's called a good leaving group. This whole group becomes a good leaving group. To understand why it becomes a good leaving group, we have to analyze and look at the resonance associated with this molecule. So let's take this and just analyze the resonance associated with this one and see if we can't figure out why. And I really drew it bigger than I wanted to draw it. So I'm going to redraw it one more time and then I'll draw it and copy that for the smaller resonance structures that we want to draw. Okay, so this one has the positive charge here on the carbon. And then if I copy this structure, this is our last resonance contributor. So what we looked at is resonance-wise, lifting the electrons up, moving the electrons over. Then what I create is a double bond in this location, and the positive charge resides on the center oxygen. Okay, it's really this structure that tells us a lot about why this becomes a good leaving group. It becomes a good leaving group because in this orientation, the oxygen is very strained. It is, let me redraw that structure and extending the bond out that is this bond. In this structure, the oxygen is struggling to hold on to everything. It's trying to add some electron density to the electron deficient side of the molecule. So this side over here is electron deficient. And it's having a very difficult time trying to do that. And that weakens the bond with the carbon on the other side. So the bond that is over here gets stressed. Because the oxygen can't hold on to everything at the same time. And so it has to let go of something. And what it chooses to let go of is it chooses to let go of that bond and break that bond. So in essence, when we draw it, the way that we draw that step is to take from the protonated carbonyl and do what's called assisted leaving. It doesn't break all on its own. It's weakened, but it needs some help to break. And so the step and the way that we refer to this is called assisted leaving. The lone pairs on a neighboring oxygen push in and push the leaving group out. So the lone pairs that are on this oxygen are the lone pairs that push in, making a double bond, breaking this bond, that bond pushes over, that breaks this bond, and pushes those electrons up onto that oxygen. So that when all is said and done, what winds up happening is the molecule has fragmented and has ejected out an equivalent of acetic acid, and it leaves as a neutral molecule. The other portion of the molecule, we will straighten out a little bit for clarity, make it a little bit easier to see what's going on. On this one, we have the new oxygen bond that has been made. Actually, that wasn't supposed to be red. We have the new oxygen bond that was made there. And I'm going to keep this end of the molecule sort of structured the same for right now. I'll straighten it out just a little bit more in the next structure. And so this step is called assisted leaving. It's really the loss of leaving group. But it's being kicked out by the other oxygen. And that's important because a leaving group can just leave sometimes when a leaving group is a really good leaving group. And then in certain mechanisms, what we get is what's called this assisted leaving. And the assisted leaving happens when there are multiple oxygens connected to the same carbon, and one of them uses their lone pairs to push out the other one. So that's the assisted leaving. And it happens because of the weakness of the bond that is here, this bond being weak, that happening because this oxygen is distressed and can't hold everything it's trying to hold on to. That's where that's coming from. Okay, once we get the assisted leaving step, the reaction mechanism is almost done. We only have one more step, and that's for our base to come back and to take the proton back away. And once the proton is taken back, then we really are at the last step. So out of this, we get an equivalent of the acetic acid. So that was our leaving group that came off. We get our acid base, our acid catalyst comes back, and we get the new bond made to our salicylic acid, which is now acetylsalicylic acid. So I've turned the molecule around a little bit there, but not very much, just to make the bond fit in and do what it's supposed to do. So this is our now acetyl salicylic acid, our acid catalyst, which has been reformed, and the acetic acid. So that's the overall reaction mechanism. What I would do is step back into this reaction mechanism a little bit. Let's go back to the beginning where we started this thing, and let's put some names to some of these steps such that when I look at this first step, is protonation. Just putting names to each of the steps, and we'll put the names underneath the arrows or next to the arrows where the step actually occurs. The next step that is here, this step is nucleophilic attack. So we're having the phenol do nucleophilic attack on the activated carbonyl. After that, the step that we get is a deprotonation. So this is deprotonation. And then we get protonation. So we're just shuttling that proton around. So we notice that we took the proton from here, and then we gave the proton back to the molecule on the other side. So that this could be considered to be the same proton, but in reality, it's probably not. These are probably protons that are coming from different places within the reaction mixture and occurring at different times. And so it's not like the same proton is getting shuttled around. It's much more likely that within solution, there are many different things that are acting as acids and bases, and that protons are being moved throughout this.
Hey, Jason? So,
yeah.
Is this all happening while we're just like stirring the reaction?
Yes, it is. And what's happening is that different molecules will be in different phases. So it's not that they're all going through this simultaneously, but what you're having is that each one of these steps can be considered to be reversible to much of a degree, and that there's a lot of equilibrium that's here. We're going to talk about that as well in terms of why we set this reaction up the way we do. But yes, all of these steps are occurring while the reaction is stirring and being heated. Yeah. Okay, next step, we had the assisted leaving. So I've got that in there. And then the final step was deprotonation. So let's count the steps. Step number one, protonation. Step number two, nucleophilic attack. Step number three, deprotonation. Step number four, protonation. Step number five, assisted leaving. Step number six, deprotonation. Six steps overall for the reaction mechanism to take place. And the rate determining step is the nucleophilic attack. Remember, the rate determining step is the step that has the highest activation energy and is the step which is the slowest step in the overall reaction mechanism. So that's your rate determining step, is the nucleophilic attack there. So what we've got is, I can't get it all on one view because I wrote it out in too extended a way, but we've got most of the reaction mechanism in there, and that rate determining step being the nucleophilic attack, making the adduct, joining the two molecules, that is your highest energy step. Okay. Questions. Let me pause for questions for a minute, let you guys catch up. And I don't know what you want to look at while you're thinking about questions, but I can bounce back and forth. Also gives me an opportunity to grab something to drink really quick. How are we doing?
We're doing good.
Okay.
Just real quick though. So there's a number of intermediate steps. I'm assuming that these, so there's the initial SN2 reaction. The ones where the reaction occurs inside the elimination reaction, does that occur really quickly, or is that, or I guess it's a slow step, fast step question.
Yeah. Not SN2. Close. It is a substitution nucleophilic, but on a carbonyl carbon. So that's different than an SN2 because SN2 has always happened at a SP3 hybridized carbon. So this is, I can't remember the name of it, but it's a substitution at a carbonyl instead, attack a carbonyl group. The fast step, slow step, the slowest step is the rate determining step. The slowest step is the nucleophilic attack. So that's the step that we're looking at that is here. This step is going to be your slowest step. The protonations, deprotonations are fast. The assisted leaving step is fast. They all have low activation energy barriers for each of those steps. So it's really the slowest step is the nucleophilic attack step, which goes back to the question of, what if I didn't use the acetic anhydride or the acid catalyst? So what would happen? What if no H3PO4 was used? Essentially, what happens if we forget to put in the phosphoric acid? Then what happens is you're looking at nucleophilic attack being your slowest step. And the comparison of these, protonated and activated, and the nucleophilic attack by the phenol on each of these, if we look at it activation energy barrier wise, the small activation energy, or the small partial positive here versus the large partial positive, what you have done is lowered the activation energy barrier through the protonation. Such that if we look at the first reaction, the activation energy barrier, and we're going to a higher, this is supposed to be protonated, we're going to a higher energy state. This is an endothermic step, but we may have a very high activation energy barrier for this step for reactants to products versus this step over here. Once we protonate that thing, this was not supposed to be protonated. Ah, you guys are letting me make mistakes. This one has a different sort of setup. It is both higher in energy overall for the starting and lower in energy for the product because of the protonated nature of the product. And so the activation energy barrier for this is smaller than the activation energy barrier over here. So this reaction is faster. So if you leave out the phosphoric acid, the reaction is just slow. It would take a very long time. The reaction would still go. It would just be a whole lot slower. So the acid catalyst is really to help the reaction mechanism go forward and to lower the activation energy by making the acetic anhydride a stronger electrophile. Thereby lowering the activation energy barrier. Okay, so that was good. Good question. Any other mechanistic questions before I move forward? Because I'm going to move forward into stoichiometry and look at the stoichiometry of the reaction. You guys are doing okay. All right, let's look at stoichiometry. So when we look at stoichiometry, what we're asking is, I don't have any other way to ask it. What is the stoichiometry of the reaction? Stoichiometry of the reaction is the reaction a 1-to-1? Is the reaction 1-to-2? Is the reaction 1-to-3? So when we're asking about the stoichiometry of the reaction, we're asking how many acetic anhydrides to how many acetic acids does the reaction require? And this is writing it out different than we would as an organic chemist. We typically don't write it this way, but the reaction written out in sort of a Chem 1A, Chem 1B sense would be said to be a 1-to-1 reaction ratio. That each of the coefficients in this, it is one salicylic acid to one acetic anhydride to one acetylsalicylic acid to one acetic acid. So the reaction stoichiometry is a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio. But when we set this reaction up, the instructions that they give us are that we are supposed to use 0.210 grams of the acetic acid and of the acetic anhydride, 0.48 milliliters. And they want these numbers to be fairly exact. And they give us some other information in the lab book. They tell us that the molecular weight of the salicylic acid is 138.1 grams per mole. And we could verify that. That is C7H6O3. And that the density of the acetic anhydride is 1.08 grams per milliliter. And that its molecular weight is 102.1 grams per mole. And that formula is C4H6O3? Okay. So the question is this being set up in a 1-to-1 ratio? And how do I know if it's being set up in a 1-to-1 ratio? But what I have to do is I sort of have to calculate it out stoichiometrically. So if I look at 0.210 grams This is of the salicylic acid, C7H6O3. And I just calculate out how many millimoles I've got. It's 138 grams per mole. And for every one mole, I get 1,000 millimoles. And that comes out to 1.52 millimoles of the salicylic acid. So remember that millimoles is a much more convenient unit of measure, because what we're generally doing is reactions at this scale are between half a millimole and up to maybe 4 millimoles. That's what small scale chemistry is usually designed to be. So calculating things out in millimoles generally makes it a little bit easier to understand. Let's look at the acetic anhydride, 0.480 milliliters of C4H6O3. That's the acetic anhydride. That one, we've got to use the density first. So for every 1 milliliter, it's 8 grams. And then once we calculate it into a mass, then we can use the 102.1 grams to get 1 mole. And then finally, for every 1 mole, we've got 1,000 millimole. And that comes out to 5.08 millimoles. And that's of the C4H6O3. So if I look at this and I think, all right, I'm using 5.08 millimoles of acetic anhydride, and 1.52 millimoles of acetic acid of salicylic acid, then what I've got is a 3.34 fold excess of acetic anhydride. And the answer is why. And we already discussed one of the answers. So one of the answers was already given, and that's that the acetic anhydride is also the solvent. So the acetic anhydride is being used as the solvent in this reaction, and therefore it's being used in excess. Number one, it's being used as the solvent. Number two, the excess is there because of the Chatelier's principle. If we use one reagent in large excess, then that drives the reaction towards the products. So by using a large fold excess of the acetic anhydride, the cheaper of the two reagents, I can push the reaction equilibrium towards the products. And the third and important component is that acetic anhydride breaks down with water, and that there is water on the glassware. And that it's hard to dry the glassware. But if you think about glass, glass is silicon dioxide. And so there are repeating units of silicon and oxygen, and these oxygens can hydrogen bond to water. And glass is very hydrophilic. Glass loves water. It is very difficult to get all the water off of glassware. Not very difficult, you just put the glassware in an oven and you heat it up. But then handling hot glassware is a little bit tricky. And so for this reaction, it's not necessary, but using a large fold excess of the acetic anhydride does help in that we lose some to water. And so by having a large excess there, it there's enough to be able to do our chemical reaction. So three reasons. It's the solvent, the Chatelier's principle, and to deal with water. That's why we're using a large fold excess. Okay. So Pavia then gives us some specific instructions. And what I want to do is I want to look at Pavia's instructions. And then I want to think about how we're going to modify the chemical reaction and why we want to modify it, or if we want to modify it, from what Pavia is telling us. So let's look at the setup that Pavia says. So number one, what Pavia says, and these are our specific Pavia instructions. And I think anytime you're dealing with a chemical reaction, you should always ask, why am I doing something this way? I don't care if those instructions are coming from a literature procedure or a textbook or wherever they're coming from. You should critically ask the question, why am I being asked to do it this way? Does this make sense? Or is there a better way to do it? And if there's a better way to do it, then you should do it the better way. But we should always be able to ask the question, why am I being asked to do something in a specific way? So the first thing that Pavia says is to heat up a water bath, and we are going to use the water bath as our heat source for this chemical reaction. They want you to heat the water bath up to 50 degrees. Easy enough. All right. And so we can throw a thermometer in here and we can heat this guy up and measure it and set it up at 50 degrees. And they don't tell you, but let's say plus or minus 10, because sometimes it's hard to get a water bath just nailed down just right. So that's our first thing, is preheat the water bath. Number two, they want you to use a 5 mil conical vial. And in the 5 mil conical vial, they want you to place the a spin vane, number one. So we use a triangular spin vane. And then we add to it the 0.210 grams salicylic acid. And then after you add the acid, the third thing that they want you to do is to take that 5 mil conical vial and to add in exactly 0.48 milliliters of acetic anhydride. So the solid is now in here, and they want us to use a pump vessel, a pump dispenser that basically has like a big rod here and a pump thing on the top. And this bottle has our acetic anhydride in it. So we add 0.480 milliliters acetic anhydride. And we just depress this and we get exactly what we asked for, so that we fill this thing up with our 0.48 milliliters. Okay, once we do that, then they want us to add the one drop of phosphoric acid. So we'll just use a dropper and we'll add in just one drop of concentrated phosphoric acid. Everything okay so far? Although I do have some questions. We'll figure out what we're doing here. So this was step four. And this is concentrated. Okay, now we heat the whole thing. So now we set it up and attach an air condenser and get it into the hot bath, and we heat it for 8 to 10 minutes. So the whole thing sets in here. We put an air condenser on it. The air condenser is really there to act as a handle, although because we're heating it, we really don't want to lose any of the acetic anhydride through the heat. And so the condenser helps to keep the acetic anhydride within the reaction vessel. And we heat at 50 degrees C for 8 to 10 minutes. Okay, after that, they have a series of steps that they want us to do. And those series of steps are, I don't know what's, this was step 5, heating for 8 to 10 minutes. 6 is cool to room temperature. Add 3 milliliters of 0 degrees C. No, is it 0 degrees C? Yeah, 3 mils of DI water. It doesn't have to be 0 degrees C, but 3 mils of DI water. And then you filter it on Hirsch. Rinse with 1 milliliter, 0 degrees C DI. Air dry it 5 to 10 minutes. I would say then to tear a petri dish. Place the crystals in the dish and weigh the crystals. Label and store. And then the second day we come back, and on the second day what we do is we reweigh. So second day we would reweigh the crystals. This would just to get the dry mass. With that mass, you can calculate your percent yield. And then we do a ferric chloride test. We do a melting point, and we do the solid FTIR. And these tests are our characterization. Of the product. All right, all well and good. Let's go back to Pavi's instructions. We happen to know that acetic anhydride breaks down in water. So if acetic anhydride breaks down in water, and we're using a water bath, and this water bath is up at 50 degrees C, it's giving off steam. So as this is evaporating some of the water and steam, it makes sense that I could be condensing some water down into my chemical reaction. So a water bath, while convenient, why would I want to use a water bath as my heating source? So this is my number one question is, do I want to use a water bath to heat with? Second question, they use the word exactly. And they use it in two places. They want you to be very careful about how much salicylic acid and how much acetic anhydride you use. The acetic anhydride is being used in a threefold, more than a threefold, almost a fourfold excess. If acetic anhydride is being used in a fourfold excess, why do I have to be so careful about how much I weigh out? Why? I mean, they're wanting me to weigh out 0.48 milliliters. 0.48 milliliters is like a really hard number to nail down and get exact. What's a number that's really close to 0.48, which is a whole lot easier to measure, especially if I don't have to be exact? 0.5. Yeah, exactly. So why not just make this 0.5 milliliters and do it that way? And also, I don't have to be so exact about this 0.20, 0.21 grams over here for salicylic acid. If I'm up a few hundredths or down a few hundredths, it's not going to hurt anything because I'm using a fourfold excess of acetic anhydride. It's really not going to make that much of a difference. So those are my big changes. Also, I don't like just having a hot plate sitting on the table. To me, that's a hazard of a specific type. So let me go copy from drawings that I made last night and show you what I want to do. So I think that's not it. Let's try here. This was me playing around with how I wanted to draw everything out last night. So this is what I want, except I'm going to use that to get it. And I'll grab this whole thing. Actually, this looks like this morning's notes, which is cool too. Okay, so here's what I want to do. Our setup. I want to have a jack stand in this. So the jack stand is this piece here that is supported by these legs that has a handle on it that allows this thing to go up and down. So the jack stand can move and lifts things up and down. And what we do is we put our hot plate on the jack stand, and then we use a sand bath as opposed to a water bath and heat the sand bath at 50 degrees C. Now I have no water vapor getting in. This eliminates the problem of the water that I was concerned about. But what the jack stand does is the jack stand allows me to raise and lower the heat. And in raising and lowering the heat, the air condenser stays affixed to the ring stand, the conical vial stays attached to the whole thing, and this will just hang in midair as the sand bath can be lowered down away from it. When the reaction is clamped in place and you move the heat, there's much less chance of spilling the chemical reaction. If you try to undo the container here and move this up and down, if you fumble it, you can drop the entire reaction and the reaction can spill or break. But if you just lower the jack stand and lower the heat, everything is much safer. So I always, whenever I do a chemical reaction and I am heating things as a safety measure, I always hook them up with a jack stand so that I can lower the heat and move heat in and out. Describe what the sand bath is. Galen, good question. Okay, so the sand bath is created by, number one, what I do is I take a beaker of appropriate size and I turn the beaker on its side. Appropriate size means that I can fit the conical vial fairly tightly within the beaker. And so my conical vial sort of fits in here. So there's enough room to fit the conical vial in. And then what I do is I take that beaker and I take a piece of aluminum foil. And actually, I don't extend it out that far. And the aluminum foil comes out about sort of like midway on the beaker. And then I roll the beaker and roll the aluminum foil around the beaker. So then what I've got is I've got this beaker that extends sort of down into here. And I've got aluminum foil, which is now wrapped around it and extends down. And this is now open at the bottom. And there's my beaker and the inside of the beaker sitting in it. And then what I do is I push it down onto the tabletop and I crush that aluminum foil on the bottom. So that what winds up happening is as I crush the aluminum foil, it makes a very nice sort of round, solid aluminum pan. And then I take it off the beaker. So this is now my aluminum sort of dish that I've created. And we take and put the conical vial inside of that. And with the conical vial inside of that, we pile sand up the edges of it. So this is all just sand, which is sitting in here. And the reason that I do this instead of just saying, well, why don't I just put the sand in the beaker and put the beaker on the hot plate? And the answer to that is that beakers break and that you're heating this thing sometimes to a fairly high degree. So I don't want to use glass in order to put this sand into. And any other sort of metal would disrupt the spin vane from being able to attach to the magnet that is inside the hot plate. Whereas aluminum doesn't do that. Aluminum is not magnetic. And so the magnetic field passing through the sand bath is uninterrupted and is allowed to connect to the spin vane. And so the spin vane can sit in here. And the magnet, which is underneath the hot plate, which sort of sits down over here. There's like this big bar magnet that is on a little rotor. And this is the positive side and the negative side. And this thing is rotating around. That's what causes the magnet inside the spin vane to spin. That all couples appropriately. And it's very easy to set up these sand baths and use these sand baths and heat sand as opposed to heating water. So that's what a sand bath is. Thanks for that question. All right, so we set up a hot plate, a jack stand, a ring stand, the clamps, and a sand bath, and we heat the sand bath to 50 degrees plus or minus 10. So all of this infrastructure is all in place. We get it all in there and we put the sand in it and we go ahead and we heat it up to 50 degrees. We get approximately 0.21 grams of salicylic acid. Then we weigh the flask with a lid on it and the salicylic acid in it. So basically what we're doing here is a tear because we're about to put the acetic anhydride in, but I want to know what the whole flask with the salicylic acid in it weighs before I put the acetic anhydride in. Then I add about half a mil, and the reason that I'm going to weigh it is because we're doing an approximation and we're using our calibrated pipette, and we don't always have faith that our calibrated pipette is perfect. So we always do this by mass. We weigh the flask. We add half a mil of acetic anhydride. We neutralize the pipette. So remember that we've done this before where we've used sodium bicarbonate solutions to neutralize pipettes. We neutralize the acetic anhydride pipette. And then we go back and we reweigh the flask. And we ask the question, when we weigh it this time, did we get a half a gram or did we get something less or something more? Remember the density on this material is 1.08 grams per milliliter. That means that if I put in half a mil, I should have about half a gram, maybe a little bit more. If we didn't put in enough, we can always go back, get a little more and reweigh it. If we put in too much, we go with it. We had a 3 or 4-fold excess anyway, a little bit more is not gonna hurt. So we just wanna check and make sure that we've added enough to make sure that there's enough solvent in here to do the chemical reaction. So that's why we're checking on that. We add our one drop of concentrated phosphoric acid. And then after adding the phosphoric acid, then we go through and we heat 8 to 10 minutes. We start the timer when the salicylic acid dissolves. 8 to 10 minutes is because we are plus or minus 10 degrees on our temperature. So if you're at 40 degrees C, maybe you're heating for 10 minutes. I put that in the wrong spot. So if we're at 40 degrees C, we're around 10 minutes. If we're at 60 degrees C, we're at 8 minutes. If we're at 50 degrees C, where we're supposed to be, then maybe somewhere 7 or 8 minutes is just fine. That's why there's a range that's given there just in case your temperature is not dialed in perfectly. Then when the time is done, we lower the heat just by lowering the jack stand and cool it to room temperature. Once it cools to room temperature, we take the flask off of the air condenser and we add 3 mils of water and we stir it with a spatula. We're going to talk about what the water is doing in just a minute because we're going to go through a separation scheme. So we'll know what the water actually did there. But after we add the water, we filter it on a Hirsch. The whole Hirsch funnel setup is here. So we have that Hirsch funnel all set up with the filter paper in it connected to the long stem. That guy, we have the pinch clamp to release the pressure, and this one goes to the vacuum. And this all sits in a water bath and everything gets a clamp around it. So everything's all clamped down. We filter it on Hirsch. We rinse the filtrate with 1 mL of 0°C DI. Not anymore, because water actually reverses the chemical reaction. So we'll talk about that in a second too. We air dry it 5 to 10 minutes, tear the petri dish, weigh the crystals, label and store in the locker. That's the whole end of the first day. Okay, a couple of things that I need to hit. I need to hit in order. I need to hit concentrated H3PO4. Need for water. Separation scheme. And reverse reaction. These are kind of fast though. Concentration of phosphoric acid. You guys have used concentrated HCl. You've used concentrated H2SO4. Now we're going to use concentrated phosphoric acid. Do you remember I'm trying to think. No, you guys probably didn't know. Do you know what the molarity of concentrated HCl is? Oh, okay. Do you know what your strong acids are? Do you remember which ones are strong acids? Yes, you're supposed to tell me what they are, not just say yes. HCl is a strong acid, yes. HCl, what's another strong acid? HBr, well, that's strong too, but that's not one of the three that we normally have you memorize. So it's normally HCl, H2SO4, and nitric. Those are your three strong acids. Those are the ones that... Didn't you say six? What's that?
Didn't you say six?
Six? What's six?
Like the six strong acids.
Did Albie have you do six strong acids in 1B?
Yeah, he said six.
So what were the six? It was HCl, HBr, HF?
And I think HI.
HI?
And...
Nitric and sulfuric.
Yeah.
Okay, I agree with that. But phosphoric's not in there, right?
No.
Okay, here's the problem. When you're dealing with concentrated acids like this, where is it? I had it up here. I forget the molarity, so I want to make sure I get the molarities. HCl is 12.1 molar. These are for the concentrated solutions. H2SO4 is 18.0 molar. And phosphoric acid is 14.8 molar. Do you guys remember normality? As opposed to molarity? Normality is equivalence per liter. So equivalence tells me how many protons I have per liter. So this is 12.1 normal. This is 36 normal because I have two protons for the H2SO4 as opposed to the one proton for the concentrated hydrochloric acid. But there are three protons for phosphoric. That means that this is 44.4 normal. I don't care that phosphoric acid is not a strong acid. I know it doesn't ionize entirely, completely. But concentrated phosphoric acid is strong acid on the order of HCl and H2SO4. It is nothing to play around with. So when you're handling concentrated phosphoric acid, you need to give it the same respect that you would give HCl or H2SO4 in terms of a strong acid. I know it's not strong, but that's a high normality. That's a lot of protons coming out of concentrated phosphoric acid.
Mind if I ask a question?
Yeah, go for it.
So I've never seen this concept before in chemistry where there's a normality.
Yeah.
So there's normality, and then there's acidity, or the ability of the proton to disassociate.
Yes.
How does normality and the actual acidity of the acid relate? Because with the that last acid you have labeled, I don't know if all the protons would disassociate, so...
They don't, that's true. But if we looked at it in terms of just even two of those protons, and two of those protons would disassociate to a fairly high degree, you're still getting about 24 normal in terms of the number of protons that are coming out of that thing. So protons that have formed hydronium, because remember that each strong acid gets leveled to hydronium. So hydronium, oh, my dog is just freaking out and I don't know how to hush her up. Hang on one second, let me try something.
Okay.
See, stop it. Okay, as long as Sadie knows that she can actually come in here, I think she will stop barking. That's her, I don't want to be alone bark. And okay, so you're right. Not all of those protons dissociate. However, strong acids always get leveled to the acidity of hydronium so that when we take a strong acid, something like HCl, and we put it into water, that what we get is we get the chloride ion plus we get hydronium. And so hydronium has a pKa of like, I don't know, -2, -3, somewhere in that range. And that all the strong acids get leveled to hydronium. So when we look at normality, we're saying how many of the protons have disassociated and are available within the solution. And so, yes, I've exaggerated it here, but I'm exaggerating it to try to make a point that don't just mess around with phosphoric acid because you think it's a weak acid. I think that's what I'm trying to say there.
I'm just curious because I have never come across that before.
Yeah, normality is actually a unit of measure that is used quite frequently with strong acids, especially acids that dissociate completely, and that they will label a normality for H2SO4 as opposed to labeling a molarity for it, such that you could then substitute other acids to hit whatever normality you need to hit in terms of the number of protons that need to be available. So that's, I think that's partly where that unit of measurement comes from. But there's a lot of units of measurement that aren't taught anymore. For instance, we usually think of molarity, but normality or molality is another one that isn't very frequently taught. And so anyway, some different units of concentration. Okay, the water. What is the water doing in this? Let's look at the separation scheme. So in the separation scheme, what we are doing is we write out all of the reactants and products that could be made in this chemical reaction. And they are all in here at the same time until we separate them out. So we get the salicylic acid, the acetyl salicylic acid. We have acetic anhydride. We have acetic acid, which has been formed. And there's water that has been, not yet. No water yet. Oh, phosphoric acid. That's what it is. H3PO4. And to this reaction, we are adding water. And it causes a separation in materials such that I get a solid and I get a liquid. The liquid being things which are dissolved in water, which are aqueous. So the water goes on this side. And the acids are the things that are going to dissolve in the water. So I'm going to get acetic acid coming out into water, phosphoric acid. The acetic anhydride breaks down with water to give me acetic acid. So when I add that in there, and the other thing that's really water soluble is the starting material, the salicylic acid. Salicylic acid is pretty water soluble. What's not so water soluble is the acetyl salicylic acid. And so that's why the filtration step allows me to be able to just separate out the acetyl salicylic acid, because when I add water to it and I stir it, what happens is I actually deactivate all of the acetic anhydride, making the acetic anhydride safer to handle. because it gets broken down with water into acetic acid. It gets rid of any phosphoric acid that was in there, and it gets rid of any starting material. And so I get a fairly clean product that comes out of this, the acetyl salicylic acid, just by filtration alone. The problem with this is that I need to be really careful about how I do this, because when you take acetyl salicylic acid and you have acid present, and you add water to it in the presence of acid, it hydrolyzes. It does the exact reverse reaction of the addition of the acete group, and it goes back to being salicylic acid. Plus, you get an equivalent of acetic acid that comes off. This is hydrolysis. And so what you want to do is you want to make sure that your filtration apparatus is all set and ready to go. When the apparatus is ready to go, you add the water, you stir it with a spatula, and then you filter it right away. You don't let it sit, such that, you know how we share these apparatuses. Let's say that somebody was using the apparatus, you were up next, but they were going to let their stuff air dry for 5 or 10 minutes. So they were just filtering, you dumped in your water, but now you got to wait 5 or 10 minutes. 5 to 10 minutes is enough time for this reaction to go backwards a substantial amount, such that it will decrease your yield, and you will see some of this hydrolysis product sitting in your product. You'll see some starting material, salicylic acid, in your product, having broken down by adding water while all those acids were still present, because all these acids are still here that can cause this material to break down.
Does it make sense to add a base to the water solution before you add it, so as you mix the two together, it neutralizes the acid? Or is it just an unnecessary step, or is it actually detrimental in some way?
It is detrimental in some way, because what happens is, if you try to neutralize all those acids, let's say that we were going to try to prevent this by adding base to it, what base does is the base, hydroxyanion, presumably, would take the proton and create an ionic compound, which would be water soluble.
Ah, thank you.
And you wouldn't be able to actually capture it at that point. So yeah, that's a great question. That's a nice way to think through it. You got to think through all the repercussions of actually doing it. But yeah, good question, Eric. Excellent question. So you want to be expeditious when we add the water. You want to make sure that the filtration apparatus is set up and ready to go. And then you want to filter right after you've added that water. This is also why we don't want to rinse with a large amount of water. We only want to rinse with 1 mL, because if you over rinse it, you're also causing the reaction to go in reverse. So that's the idea there. Okay, I've been talking for a long time. This has been a long lecture, and it always is, because the actual reaction only takes 8 to 10 minutes. And so we can go through this whole lab lecture and then turn you guys loose, still get the reaction done. We're a little pressed for time, but it gets you through all of this. And then the second lab, then we get to talk about all this other stuff of actual characterization, what it looks like, how to do the FTIR, how to do solid FTIR. And then we'll add a third day where we talk about lab reports and putting all that into it. So I'm happy to stay on the line and answer any further questions, but I've hit it through all the content that I wanted to hit. Finley is ready for me to be done. Finley is hanging out here with me, and he's saying it is time to be done with lecture. But I'm happy to stick around and answer any other questions that you guys have, if you have them.
Hey, Jason, I have a quick question.
Go for it.
When you take aspirin, what keeps it from getting hydrolyzed by your stomach acid?
It does get hydrolyzed by your stomach acid to a large degree, but that hydrolysis within the stomach acid still allows your body to process it and to, I don't know that it hydrolyzes 100%, but yeah, there is some hydrolysis that happens. And even if we take some old aspirin, That's a great question too. If you take old aspirin that's been sitting around in your house for a couple of years and you analyze it, you'll find that it has some broken down hydrolysis product in it that water, as it creeps into those pills just on sitting, causes the reverse reaction, and some of it has converted into salicylic acid. It's just that if you take a large dose of salicylic acid, that it causes that mucous membrane irritation, and the acetylsalicylic acid does it to a lesser degree. It still hydrolyzes in your stomach and still produces salicylic acid.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Good question. Anything else?
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
I know you probably get bored sometimes and you want to do your own synthesis. So you probably go on a website to find out how to do that synthesis. What website do you go on?
That's a good question. And actually, I don't do that. I tend to play a game where if I want to make something, what we do is retrosynthetic analysis. We look at different ways of breaking down a material that we want to make by specific bond disconnections in order to put the molecule back together. And it takes basically two types of steps. Retrosynthetic analysis tells you what bonds you can disconnect. And then there is a step that we call sequencing, or I like to call sequencing, which says, what order do I have to do them in order to make it work out? And that is something that we do a lot second semester. So second semester is a lot of retrosynthetic analysis. How do I tear down a molecule? And so you can actually just look up retrosynthetic analysis, and you can find some websites that will give you retrosynthetic analysis. And give you some of the basics. Your textbook also has a little bit of retrosynthetic analysis in it. I don't know of any websites that give you synthesis to look up. Although, I don't have a good website for that. That's a great question. I don't know what you're up to, and I may not want to know.
No, I'm not. I'm not up to anything bad.
But if you're interested in that, that's something that you and I can talk about more. We could do a little bit of that in office hours, and we could talk about just synthetic analysis, and I can show you how that actually works, and I can give you some references to look up, some places to look.
Okay.
We could talk about that some more. That is a fun skill to practice, and is one of the different types of organic chemistry professions, that there are people who do structure elicitation, there are people who do methodologies, who do stereoselective synthesis, and then there are other people who do what's called total synthesis. And the job of those people that do total synthesis are taking very large molecules that are natural products and finding ways to make them in the lab, sometimes taking as many as 20, 30, or even 40 steps in order to make a single product in the lab. So that's a cool, very cool area of organic chemistry. And yeah, we'll talk about that too. All right, anything else?
Have you ever synthesized something?
I've synthesized a lot of things.
Your free time?
Not in my free time. Although I don't know what you mean by free time, but no, in grad school, there was a lot of materials that I made that were the first time those materials had ever been made. They'd never been synthesized before. So they had to do with the glucose sensor that I was trying to make, and we were making original molecules. And yeah, I was synthesizing all kinds of things, that I was devising my own process to make them, and making my own products and making things that had never been made before. So yeah, that's pretty cool. But in my own time, no, I don't just go into the lab and make things. Not that that wouldn't be fun, but it's just too busy. The teaching is all encompassing, and having enough time to go in and play in the lab, there's not a whole lot of time for that. Yeah. Anything else? All right, guys, let's call it a day. And if you have any other further questions, you want to stay on the line, I'll stay on for a little bit. But other than that, let's call it from here. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about how we do, how we analyze the structure and do product analysis. All right.
Thank you, Jason.
Hey, thank you, guys. Thanks for hanging in there with me on a long lecture. That was awesome.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Jason. See you Wednesday.
Yep.